So, what animal would be brilliant at physics?
I think birds would be very good, but dogs not so much. Let me explain. The dog's world is a world primarily based on smell. It's very, very hard to get from sensations of smell to Newton's laws of motion, for instance, in mechanics. Spiders would have a different perspective. They communicate through touch and vibrations of their webs. They would have a very good entry into field theory, you know, and the idea that the world is controlled by vibrations of electric and magnetic fields, they would find very congenial, and they probably could get to that pretty rapidly. It's just humans, who are primarily visual animals, we have the capability of seeing things very, very far away. We're lucky that we can see the planets, and that gives us a nice opening into astronomy and understanding gravity. Birds would have all that and more, because whereas our experience is dominated by friction and the force of gravity here on Earth, birds would just experience that in their everyday life. You know, they beat their wings for a while, then stop, and they just glide. So they know about inertia. They experience that every day. Birds, if they became intelligent, would make more rapid progress on physics than humans.
I wish I was a bird. This is Frank Wilczek. He's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist at MIT, and he's kind of obsessed, in his own way, with understanding the universe. And specifically, he's interested in what he calls the beautiful question. Is the universe naturally, inherently beautiful? So, of course, Steve Paulson wanted an answer.
Frank, the question you're asking, is there beauty in the design of nature, would seem to be a matter of aesthetics. Is this also a scientific question?
It is a scientific question. It has two sides, at least. The exact question I'm trying to address is, does the world embody beautiful ideas? And that's a question about the world on the one hand and beauty on the other.
Does this matter? I mean, for a scientist, does it matter if the world is beautiful, if it's a work of art?
Well, I don't think of science as something walled off from the rest of life. So it matters. Yes, it matters to me a lot whether the world is beautiful. You know, I hope that it would be. It also is, in a strange way, a practical question for physicists and others, engineers, designers. Specifically, for instance, at the frontiers of physics, we're dealing with realms of the very small or the very large and the very strange, where the source of intuition is not so much from everyday experience or from massive accumulation of facts, but from feelings of what would make sense, what would make things harmonize, what would make the laws have more inner coherence, more beauty. And my work has very much been guided by trying to make the laws more beautiful.
Well, I want to pick up this idea of beauty and take it back even further in history. I mean, because it's an ancient idea. I mean, it goes back to the ancient Greek philosophers, right?
Yes. Especially Pythagoras and Plato yearned for beauty in the description of the physical world. Pythagoras famously said all things are numbers and believed in the music of the spheres, and even thought he heard the music of the spheres and wanted the harmony. The laws he discovered were laws of harmony and proportion.
And the Pythagoreans, I mean, there was a branch of it that actually became a religion, a kind of mystical cult.
It was a religion. It was, I think, as far as I know, the world's only mathematical religion. They were, in a sense, number worshippers, number mystics of...
What would that mean to worship numbers?
Well, it's if you find concepts like music of the spheres attractive and a way of helping to understand the way things work, and you find that one of the great goals of life should be to understand the world better and understand it quantitatively, that's a kind of worship of numbers. You know, I think many modern scientists, not in an organized way and not with a theology, but they have very much the same kind of spirit of trying to understand the deep structure of the world. And that's their goal. That's what they find rewarding. That's their mission in life. And so it's kind of, it's not so different from Pythagoreanism.
So are you a modern Pythagorean yourself?
Yeah, among other things, right? I can understand that and sympathize with it a lot, yeah.
Well, and then Plato talked about how there were these perfect forms that were sort of the underlying reality. I mean, what we see in the physical world is basically just an illusion, but there was some...
An imperfect copy. This was his idea. It was that there was an ideal cat of which all existing cats are just imperfect copies, for instance. And this, at some level, was an attempt to reconcile the aspirations of the Pythagoreans to perfect harmony and perfect structure and perfect regularity with the fact that the world that we actually experience certainly has messy aspects and imperfections.
Well, then Plato had that allegory about the cave. It's sort of like, you know, we're all prisoners chained in the cave, and all we see are the flickering shadows of the real people who are outside the cave. I mean, it's kind of a profoundly pessimistic view of what we can actually understand about the world, isn't it?
Well, it's a pessimistic view of what we do understand about the world, and well, it also depends on who we are. but yes, it's the idea that if you don't try to get beyond and escape the cave, that ordinary experience gives you only a very, very partial view of reality. But there's a world outside that's bigger and brighter and more ideal that you can hope to access if you study Platonic philosophy, or more generally, if you, you know, sort of escape from the everyday experiences and get beyond them, enhance your perception using instruments, using insight, then you can experience much more of reality. So I view it optimistically, actually, saying, so it's a statement that, yes, perception is limited, but that, if you think about it, that's also a challenge. Let's do better.
You know, in some ways, you strike me as being somewhat unusual for a scientist. I mean, you clearly love art. You have a strong philosophical bent. You love exploring these big ideas. Did you ever think about becoming a philosopher rather than a physicist?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. When I was a teenager, my heroes, I guess, were Einstein on the one hand, but Bertrand Russell on the other. I loved reading Bertrand Russell's books and reading about philosophy and thinking about those kinds of questions. And
why did you become a physicist then?
Well, I really liked mathematics. I liked playing with patterns always and thinking about that kind of abstraction, and I was good at it. But physics at that time was tremendously exciting and fruitful, and I decided that, you know, this was what was happening, and so I jumped in that direction.
Well, and
I've never regretted it.
Yeah, well, obviously. I mean, the astonishing thing about your personal history is that you made a discovery about the strong interaction, one of the fundamental laws of nature, when you were very young. What, 21 years old?
Yes.
And this is what, of course, won you the Nobel Prize many years later.
Yes.
When you were 21 years old.
Yes. Well, you know, there was a large element of luck in that. The discovery was there to be made. It didn't require really knowing a lot about physics. It didn't require years of experience. It just required calculating the right thing. I was also very fortunate that I hooked up with David Gross, who was my collaborator and advisor at that time. So, you know, it didn't have to be that way, but I was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time with a lot of leverage and some good ideas and a lot of energy to put it together.
Yeah. So we've been talking about sort of philosophy and physics, and it's worth pointing out that in the last few years, some very high-profile physicists, from Stephen Hawking to Lawrence Krauss to Neil deGrasse Tyson, have all made rather disparaging comments about philosophers, basically saying that what they do does not have much value anymore to the real world of science. What do you make of these attacks on philosophy by your colleagues?
I think it shows lack of imagination and lack of knowledge, frankly, of what philosophy is all about. There's a lot about the world besides the laws of physics and laws of astronomy and the phenomena of physical science. I mean, I've derived tremendous inspiration, as did Einstein, by the way, from the philosophical literature, from sharpening your mind against David Hume or Ernst Mach or Bertrand Russell. They have a lot to offer.
Of course, the real question that philosophers ask is not just how everything fits together, but does it have meaning? Does the universe or do the laws of physics have meaning? Mm-hmm. Does that question have resonance for you?
Yes, of course. How could you not think? Yeah, I mean, I very much care about what it all means. That's what drives a lot of what I do. And, you know, having derived what it is, then you can hardly help thinking about what it means.
Okay, so what does it mean?
Well, I don't think that's the right question in that form, actually, because I'm not sure what an answer to it would look like. You can always, okay, so if it means A, then you say, what does A mean? If it means B, what does B mean? You know, but I was very happy to come up with a version of that question, which is not the same, but I think has some of the elements of it and can be answered or can be addressed in a very fruitful way, which is exactly the question, does the world embody beautiful ideas? And that's a question that you can look at in a very enlightening way because you can compare what people's ideas about beauty have been historically before they knew the laws of physics and what they hoped for and what we've actually found. You can compare and get an enriched perspective on both art and science from that.
So basically what you're saying is if there's some part of you, not just you personally, but anyone, needs some sort of deeper system of values to fall back on. I mean, to give you sustenance to keep on going, beauty would not be a bad place to look for it.
Yes. Some people derive joy and understanding from received dogmas of different religions, and that's a possible way to organize your life. Myself, I don't find that possible because I don't find any of the received religions do justice to what I know about the physical world, what I've discovered during my career. It's not so much that they're wrong, although many details are wrong, but that they just don't do justice to the profound surprises that science turns up about how things actually work and how big the universe it is, how old it is, how many little things go into making up the big things we experience in life. So that means it's on us to figure out, to make a meaning, to discover the meaning. And for me, one of the big discoveries about that goes in that direction of what it all means is that it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful. And that's guided a lot of my work and has been a great source of joy.
I hope you find something beautiful today. That's Nobel Prize winning physicist Frank Wilczek talking with Steve Paulson about his book, A Beautiful Question, Finding Nature's Deep Design,